Last week, we started a short series about what matters most, about core values. It had been occasioned for me from listening to the debates around the EU referendum and reflecting on the fact that it was probably the case that most of the decisions that most of us made and most people were making were more to do with what they felt, their values, than the complex and imponderable information that we were trying to absorb. And I did the work on this and then realised that it would fit into some of the categories in the series on spiritual intelligence, which is based on the idea that we have recognised that there are a set of skills and aptitudes and attitudes which we talk about as intelligence, and people have realised that that kind of thinking intelligence, cognitive intelligence, needs to be supplemented, and have introduced the idea of emotional intelligence. And for some time now, there's been some work going on about saying, in terms of responding to the spiritual side of the way we're made, are there some things which are important to have going for us? And last week, as the first of three stories about values, we looked at the assertion that spiritually intelligent people work to acquire spiritual wealth. So the idea which is fundamental to the way Jesus spoke in the New Testament is that you can actually set material wealth against spiritual wealth, that they are similar in some ways. Certainly they provide resources, but they're different. At the end, we did some breakout work and thought about what it might mean to be spiritually rich, and we talked about these kind of things. We made a list. Now, earlier in the session, where the story we told was the story of the rich fool. You know, what had happened was that some people came to Jesus and said they had a row about inheritance between two brothers, about who got what money. That's something that hasn't changed in society when it comes to inheritance. It's a sure basis for family rows. And Jesus took the opportunity to sidestep what people wanted to talk about into talking about something else, which was about the values issues underlying the conversation. And so he talked for a while and told us a very simple story about somebody who had done really well in business. And this person, of course, you measured your business in what your land produced. He got a load of grain. And he said, my barns just can't hold all this stuff. I'm going to build bigger ones. And he said, just take it easy. You've got enough going for your retirement. And God said, you fool. Wasn't the same word as that word raka, which nobody was supposed to say under any circumstances. It was another word, you stupid person. You person lacking spiritual intelligence. Yeah? Tonight, your life will be demanded of you. And it makes the point that it's all very well to think you've got the future sewn up, but there are other things that are important. Now, today I'm going to stay in the same chapter, which is chapter 12 of Luke, and just want to signal the fact that this is complex stuff, because Peter, during the conversation, said this. It's not verses 15 to 21. It's a single verse, somewhere around about verse 15, I think. He said, Lord, are you telling us this parable to us or to everybody? And that's really key to understanding that chapter. I'm not going to go there, but you need to split out the audiences for the different bits that Jesus was talking about on that occasion. If you want to get behind some of the... Oh, and I'll come to that in just a moment. Jesus started off by saying, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. Now, in terms of our value-laden behaviour, in terms of what we give our priorities to, in terms of what we give our time to, then you would think that our life did was constituted of possessions. That's where our focus is for lots of us and for most of us. It's a worthwhile conversation to have to say, how can we change this? We live on a sort of merry-go-round. We have to keep the wheels turning to make sure there's enough money to survive. But it's clear that there's something quite important going on here, because at the end of it, Jesus says about this guy who was in a dreadful situation in the end, said, this is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God. So that's the end of the first section. Then Luke chooses to put in at that particular point the whole section about the lilies of the field, the birds of the air, although here they're ravens and not sparrows. He talks about the fact that you shouldn't be worried. And then at the end of that section, the next section, bear in mind what he's done is Jesus has told a really scary story. He's basically been saying, you think you've got your life planned out, do not think too far ahead, because today may be the last day. And a number of us, after the session, as you do on those occasions, found ourselves telling stories about people who had died suddenly, you know, whose lives had been cut short. And of course, most times it doesn't happen, but sometimes it does. And so after telling this scary story, Jesus said, at the end of the next section, don't be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. Okay? Now that's the way that scary story is supposed to fit into our thinking. That's how it fits. That's where it is. We're not supposed to go running around going, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, what's going to happen to me? But to realise that we're not going to be that kind of people. We've set our direction. We know the way we're going to live. We're not going to be in that position. So, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions, give to the poor. Provide purchases for yourselves that will not wear out. A treasure in heaven that will never fail, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And today, my focus for the next 25 minutes or so is that spiritually intelligent people take a long-term view. And I'm focused up on this because I asked the question in one of the breakout groups last time, let's just assume that tonight your life is required of you, your life ends, how will it be for you tomorrow morning? And there was a lot of jaw dropping, and there wasn't the usual sort of busy discussion. And Wendy and I talked about it over lunch, and we decided, yes, it was a good thing to explore, but that it wasn't surprising that it was difficult to do so. Now, I've got two things playing in my mind here. One, I'm of a fairly practical bent, and so I don't tend to pay attention so much to those sort of things. And as most of you know, just recently, both of my parents died. They'd been committed Christians for a long time. And that led me to some reflection. And as a result of that, I thought, well, before I stand up again, I need to read just a bit about this. And I have spent some of this week reading a book by a very able writer. On this occasion, he's called Tom Wright. When he's writing accessible books, he's called Tom Wright. When he's writing academic books, ones that have more than 800 pages, and he's got one with 1,600 pages that came out a year or so ago, he's known as N.T. Wright, the Reverend Professor N.T. Wright. He was Bishop of Durham and is an amazingly thoughtful, lucid, prolific writer. And on this occasion, he's talking about Christian hope. And he's talking about it from a very straightforward, Bible-oriented, evangelical Christian point of view. And I have found it really exciting to read. But that's because I'm a boring old person anyway, probably you will say. And I do find heavy books interesting to read. Now, I'm not sure how much I want to talk to you about that this morning. I will make some side references to it. If you want to know more, you can ask any member of the core team for a summary that I circulated during the week. And if you want to get the book, you're welcome to borrow this copy in a while, because once I've finished the series, it will probably go back on the shelf. Just remember you've got it, because I haven't got any good system of making sure that books come back. Anyway, I want to go on. So that's the context. There's going to be a lot of N.T. Wright in what I'm saying this morning. But here's the next story. It starts off like this. Be dressed, ready for service, and keep your lamps burning like servants waiting for their master to return from a wedding banquet, so that when he comes and knocks, they can immediately open the door for him. It will be good for those servants whose master finds them watching when he comes. Go on a bit, the rest of the story. Truly, I tell you, he will dress himself to serve, will make them recline at the table, and will come and wait on them. It will be good for those servants whose master finds them ready, even if he comes in the middle of the night or towards daybreak. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known what hour the thief was coming, he would not have let his house be broken into. You must also, you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Right, I'm going to read that through once more. And I'm going to ask you then just to talk to one another for 3 minutes about what strikes you about the passage. A couple of things that strike you, and we'll do a little bit of feedback on that and then do some more reflection. So here we go. Right, start of the story is this. Bear in mind the context is he's just said, don't be frightened, little flock. Okay, don't be frightened, don't be frightened. That's the introduction to this bit. Be dressed, ready for service, and keep your lamps burning like servants waiting for their master to return from a wedding banquet, so that when he comes and knocks, they can immediately open the door for him. It will be good for those servants whose master finds them watching when he comes. Truly, I tell you, he will dress himself to serve, will make them recline at the table, and will come and wait on them. It will be good for those servants whose master finds them ready, even if he comes in the middle of the night or towards daybreak. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have let his house be broken into. You also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come in an hour when you do not expect him. Okay, so you've got the passage. Here's the question. What couple of things strike you about that story? Have a chat about it for 3 minutes and we'll take some feedback. Okay. Okay, as most of the time with breakout groups like this, you can't possibly be wrong, because the question is what strikes you, not what strikes somebody else. So, what strikes you about the passage? Anybody want to make a comment? Yeah.
Having the lamp burning.
Okay.
It's actually just what I think, it's being available with the Holy Spirit in your life, making you aware of things. It's not like you're just running and running and running. It's actually just being aware.
So that's the image that comes to you, having your lamps burning. that it's a it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because there's a much more detailed exploration of that in Matthew's Gospel, and I suppose one of the interesting things to reflect on, if you're that kind of person, is why is it that Luke just glances on that on this occasion and emphasises different bits of that story? So being available, the notion of the Holy Spirit, the light, the flame, there. Anything else that struck you?
I wanted to ask the question, the owner of the house and the thief, is Jesus one of them, or is it somebody else?
Okay, brilliant, brilliant question. Can I refer you to N.T. Wright chapter? Just stick this in your head for a moment. I think there are arguments against this. Wright thinks that all these things are not about the second coming. They're about the first coming. Now, the reason why we think they're about the second coming is because Paul picks them up and applies the images in 1 Thessalonians 4. The thief image is applied with some other things there. And there's a really good few pages about that. If I get a chance, I'm going to see you this evening. I'll photocopy them beforehand. I'll try and do so. I think the problem there is real mixed metaphors. You know, when we were looking at crowning with many crowns this morning, what we did was we just took out the verses that had got most extended metaphors in them and so had four of the least worst verses to sing from the point of view of complexity. And that's what you've got happening here, is you think you've got 3 years of Jesus' talk being pushed down and concentrated into a very small space. And John at the end says, if all the things that Jesus said and did were written down, I suppose that the whole world couldn't hold the books. And of course, that's a pre-digital age, but it was saying that there was a lot of summary going on. Yeah, anything else?
Soften it a bit is the bit about he will dress himself to serve, will make them recline at the table, will come and wait on them. The concept of what God, Jesus went through, and me then being at a table and him coming and serving me is a bit kind of
It's the whole idea of reversal, isn't it, that comes in. Anything else? Okay. Let me tell you the things that particularly struck me as I read it. And I have to say, by the way, that I haven't watched any of the Despicable Me Irv, which was perhaps why I felt so free to use the visuals. I know that there are some of you who are very enthusiastic about it. There's something else that many of you are enthusiastic about, but I've never, ever watched. But it seemed to me that that's a useful point of reference. There are lots of pictures you get in all sorts of stories, aren't there, of Rolls Royces and Lagondas drawing up outside 1920s houses with a whole row of servants stood out there in front, and people being on duty all the time. On the rare occasion that I've stayed in very smart hotels and come down late at night or in the early hours of the morning to get off somewhere, to see people who appear to be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. The closest I ever got to that was being involved in early morning radio from time to time, where it was my turn to do Thought for the Day or Thought for the Week. And it was absolutely not done ever to mention that you were tired, to yawn, to rub your eyes, or to do anything like that, because you were on duty. You know, you were there, you were bright-eyed, you were ready to go. So, ready for service, keep your lamps burning like servants waiting for their master. Now, that's a whole interesting thing, isn't it? Waiting for people to turn up. Even if you're expecting them. Quite often, last Friday week, I was in the middle of writing a text to Andy, which was checking up on something with him, and Wendy shouted downstairs, "They're here." which meant that our grandsons and daughter-in-law had arrived for the day. And so I stopped exactly where I was and wondered why Andy never replied to the text that I never sent, because I was on duty from that time onwards until we'd been to Bowood and fired all the Nerf guns in the world, and they had set off back home and we could sink into our armchairs. But that's an interesting notion. There is a strange feeling about this, isn't it? That there is a, is there any point in this? And I may get to tell you just how I've been reflecting on that. But then there was that other thing that Marion mentioned, and that's the idea that if we're on duty, if we're doing our bit, when it comes, it won't be a grind, it will be a great pleasure. It will be a great celebration to be with him. And I have been wondering just why it is that we get stuck on that at the moment. And in thinking about that, my understanding's improved a bit, I think, on this. It all goes back to the resurrection, which is why it was just fortuitous, the fact that I'd ended up doing Breaking Bread this month and I was talking this morning. Because if you go back to the resurrection story, and when I say story, that's not because I don't believe it. I believe that it is the most important story, most important bunch of facts in the world. The fact that Jesus came back from death with a body starts the whole process moving. You see, it says that he became the first fruits of those who die, of those who sleep. So he came back and walked around with a body, okay, with a body, for 50 days, that was very different to the kind of bodies we have at the moment. It could pass through walls, and yet it wasn't non-material, because he was able to eat. Okay? That is weird. And we've got some sort of idea about what life after death will be like from the culture. But if you were to go into work tomorrow morning and ask your friends, say, look, I'm doing a little bit of study, we've been reflecting on this recently, what do you think the prevailing ideas are about life after death and what it's like? What do you think their responses would be? Just take 60 seconds on that. What do you think, if you were to ask people about life after death, for those 50% or so who believe in life after death in some form, what would be the predominant ideas? What would they think? Okay. Predominant ideas about life after death. I'm going to pick on somebody and then we get the thing flowing. Dawn, people you've talked to.
Around where I am, there's a couple of people who've been brought up as Catholics.
Uh-huh.
They would probably still hold the Catholic tradition.
Which is?
Well, probably death, and then you have purgatory, so you have to do that. You have to say mass for them.
Yeah.
And get them through it.
Yeah, that idea hooks into the notion of paradise as well, as being a sort of waiting place between, the fact that things can change while people are in purgatory, which in some ways can be a really helpful idea. It emerged 14th century, and I think was probably... had some business-driven reasons behind it, and indirectly led, of course, to the Reformation, as people resisted It was corruption that actually led Luther to want to do what he did. But those guys didn't have a corner on corruption. It spreads out to all sorts of places. Anything else that people would think around? Of course, what this is saying is there's no consensus among Christians about what happens after death either. Rachel?
I'm thinking of my friend who would think of going into a spirit world changing the spirit.
So the notion of spiritual existence, just in a sentence or so, what would they mean by spiritual existence?
I think it's the idea almost of fairies, of angels, of fairy
light. Yeah.
Different kind of existence.
And it's easily done with your hands, isn't it? I think I don't know whether they're talking in terms of non-materiality. But I think that's possibly there. That's sort of that owes quite a lot to Plato, rather than Charles Kingsley or whoever else wrote about fairies and things. Anybody, anything else that you get?
People still think about the very much, well, their minds can't still free themselves from the physical aspect of it. This whole thing about climbing the ladder to heaven.
Yeah.
And then, you know, all these creatures in heaven, and you know, and sort of. Be there with all these noisy things, always praising God all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, no, let me be, you know. That's
you. That isn't anybody else. Yeah. Let me be. Yes. When I get to heaven, I shall be a grump. And of course, we haven't helped by pictures like this, have we? Yeah. A cloud received him out of their sight. We've got this image of Jesus going up with just a pair of feet sticking out in the end. And then we read that in the same manner as you saw him go, you will see him come again. And there's that sort of feeling. And there are lots of ways of understanding the issue of the other place that don't require the sort of upness of heaven. A cloud received him out of their sight. There must have been that transitional phase as Jesus disappeared. But then trying to actually construct a photograph of what happened then is not going to be profitable. But I think it's very evident that Jesus went with his body. Okay? Have a think about that. It's one thing you can take away. You can bank that one. But there are bodies in heaven. But it does mean that matter and space and time are very different to the way that we know it. I don't know how you understand up. The Eastern Church actually has a model of heaven. And my experience of their model of heaven was in November 1988, possibly 1989, but it was when the Soviet Union was breaking up. And I was in Armenia. And it was only there a couple of nights at a monastery where they were training seminarians. And we went into the morning service, and you'd got 36 lads in their late teens singing the service. It was impressive. They're all gowned up. And in fact, there were so many seminarians at the time, there'd been a massive change, that they could only have half of them singing, because they could only get them into half of them into heaven. Because within the Orthodox tradition, you've got a rail, which is the inner sanctuary, and the inner bit is heaven, and the outer bit is earth. So it's inner and outer, rather than up and down. And of course, we talk very frequently about people going up to big school. Okay? Very rarely is big school on the next floor. I think it used to be sometimes in these sort of Victorian, Edwardian school buildings. But the sense of upness is moving on to somewhere else that's better and bigger. But, of course, one of the things we have in our minds is the idea that when that state comes, what it is about us going there. Now, one of the things that's absolutely fundamental to evangelical Christian belief, and we quite often forget about it, is this idea that Jesus who went away will come back again. Now, the reason we forget about it frankly, is because it makes our heads hurt to think about it, trying to get round it. And I don't have time on Sunday mornings to go into that in any sort of detail, but it is really interesting that Jesus' intention was to go away in order to come back, not to go away in order to take us to be somewhere in this ethereal state where we wouldn't really know what was going on and we wouldn't be able to have a grip on it. So this idea, which I was brought up on, you know, there's a gospel train coming and you've got to get on board and you've got to do it as quickly as possible because there's going to come a time when the whistle blows. Jesus may have paid for your ticket, but you've got to get on board and then you're going to go and you're going to go to another world and we're going to leave this horrible, stinky world behind and have nothing more to do with it. And of course, that leads to a particular view of creation as well. So I've run out of time, but what I wanted to say at that point, that you see, this reflection has led me to beginning to make a bit more sense of how things are at the end of life. Because for my parents, they had a fairly miserable end to their lives. They were ill, they were in serious pain, and for my dad in particular, it went on for several years. And I know that while he was able to hang on to his faith, there were lots of disappointments and challenges. But if we get our understanding right of the Bible, and if I line up my understanding with what is clearly there, it starts to make sense of it all. Yeah? Because my dad, as some of you know, was crippled when he was 9 years old. Always, he went through life with a damaged leg. I'm just wondering what for him this business of being embodied means. I think it's quite delightful for him. I think of my mum and think of what it is like for her to be without pain. And think that must be an amazing thing. And I think particularly of the fact that they invested huge amounts of their time over years in other people. And towards the end, they had a pretty rough deal, really. Some people didn't come to see them. Some people didn't come to see them because my mother could never find a convenient time when people could visit. And she could be really, really, really difficult like that, even with us, because life had to be terribly well organised, and if it wasn't. But they will be in the position now, if the story of the resurrection really sticks, where they will be able to know that their work was not in vain. Okay? So it must seem very much to them as though, rather than them waiting on Jesus and doing the work, he is waiting on them and looking after them. Now that's as far as I've got. I don't know whether I'll go any farther down this road next week, but we said three stories, so three stories we will do. And of course, there are a shed load of stories in the New Testament to be able to pick out on this particular aspect of life. But here's the sentence with which you need to finish. And we won't discuss this now. Sell your possessions, give to the poor. Provide purses for yourselves that will not wear out. Okay? There's an image for you. We'll start off with that next week. I'm going to ask you, okay, tell me what kind of purse Jesus was talking about at the time. What will that sort of purse look like? A purse that will not wear out. And I'm also going to ask, are you teaching your kids to have a purse like that so that they develop good financial habits? That's it. Go think. come back again next week.